This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, we'll get to the bottom of an important shift in how the U.S. Supreme Court is doing its work. Then, how can a powerful man sexually harass women at work and have that be just an open secret nobody does anything about? Also, what your preference for waking up early or sleeping late says about your personality. That's coming up on Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. When the U.S. Supreme Court issued a late-night ruling a couple of weeks ago refusing to block the strict new abortion law in Texas, you may have started hearing about something called the shadow docket. It's not a new thing, but the Supreme Court has been using it differently in recent years, with important implications for all of us. So we've got Stephen Vladek on the line to explain. He's a professor at the University of Texas School of Law, one of the top experts on this subject. When the U.S. House held a hearing on the shadow docket earlier this year, they called on Vladek to testify. Professor, welcome. Thanks for taking some time today.
Thanks, Julie. Great to be with you.
Let's define it. What puts the shadow in the shadow docket?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple different things. So we should give credit where it's due. The term was coined by University of Chicago law professor Will Bode in 2015. And Will used the term to basically mean everything the Supreme Court does that we don't usually see, hence the shadow. And, you know, technically this was a reference to the Supreme Court's orders as opposed to its big fancy opinions, and just how much more stuff the Supreme Court is deciding and how many more of these orders are actually affecting, you know, Julie, people like us on the ground compared to what's been true historically. So the shadow is both that, like, they're unseen, that to some degree they are unexplained. These tend to be short decisions if we get any explanation at all. They often come literally late at night. I mean, the ruling in the SB 8 case came at 11:58 Eastern time on September 1st. And so, you know, I think however you want to stretch the metaphor, I think it captures a lot of features about this increasingly important part of the Supreme Court's work.
What exactly, what else is there for the Supreme Court to do besides the cases that it, you know, holds oral arguments and then 3 months later we get a ruling?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, the Supreme Court gets asked to hear about 6,000 cases a year. And these days it really only ends up hearing about 60. So that's 1%. And the other 99%, Julie, there's a lot of work there to decide both is the court going to hear this case or not. And while the court's deciding whether to hear this case, what happens in the lower court? So one of the areas where we've seen the biggest uptick in these kinds of orders and these orders having impacts is in what we might call applications for emergency relief. So I'm bringing a lawsuit, let's say, against a defendant. And, you know, I want the defendant to be ordered to stop doing something. And the question is, while we fight over whether I should win, what should the status quo be? Should I be allowed to get the defendant to stop doing this while the lawsuit's going on? Or should the defendant be allowed to keep doing the thing that I'm challenging while the lawsuit's going on? And so we've seen so many more of these cases, Julie, where parties don't get the early relief that they want. Or courts do provide, and the other party's pissed off, and they run up to the appellate courts and then to the Supreme Court saying, wait, while this litigation unfolds, we want you to restore the status quo, or we want you to change the status quo. And the Supreme Court's doing a lot more of that. That's where we've really seen this massive rise in the shadow docket.
Is that really what the Supreme Court is for, though, to be sort of the I mean, you're not supposed to be able to jump the line. There's a whole process you have to get through. And so why is it that someone can say, well, I didn't get the ruling I liked in this court, but it's probably going to take me 6 months to a year, maybe longer, to kind of get through the next appeal and the next appeal? Why is this a new thing where people are able to kind of jump ahead past all of that and ask the Supreme Court to kind of intervene before it's even really time for the Supreme Court to intervene?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short answer is it's not a new thing in the abstract, Julie. I mean, there are famous examples going back throughout history. It was, you know, a shadow docket ruling that temporarily blocked the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in 1953. It was on the shadow docket that the court fought over an effort to stop the bombing of Cambodia in 1973. The real shift, Julie, is in volume, that, you know, for whatever reason, there are a lot more of these cases. And I think critics like me would say the court has relaxed its standards to some degree, that it's granting relief in context where in the past it would have just shrugged off the application, said, you know, suck it up while the lawsuit keeps going. And that, you know, the more the court has granted this kind of relief, the more the court has shown a willingness to intervene early in a case as opposed to later, you know, not surprisingly, the more parties have asked them to. And so I think it's been a bit of a snowball effect over the last 4 or 5 years.
Right. Once they kind of allowed it once or twice, then other people got wise to that. So what has the trend been most recently that over the last, I mean, that would have led Professor Bode in 2015 to kind of create a name for this and start drawing more attention to it?
Yeah, I mean, what's funny is things have actually gotten so much more dramatic since he coined the term. So what Will was responding to 6 years ago was a rise in a very specific kind of ruling, what Supreme Court nerds call a summary reversal. This is when the Supreme Court, at the stage where a party is actually asking it to take up its appeal, just decides the appeal. And what Will was criticizing was that the court was doing this more and more often without giving the parties another opportunity for briefing, which they usually get if the case is taken up for review, without having oral argument, in short opinions that, you know, are usually unsigned and fairly cryptic. And what's remarkable is, like, that, you know, that just pales in comparison to what we've seen in the 6 years since. That, you know, now we're not just getting summary reversals where the court is resolving the whole appeal. We're getting these emergency injunctions. The court has issued so far this term 7 different orders where the court itself reached out to block state COVID restrictions at the very beginning of a lawsuit when lower courts had refused to. That 7, Julie, compared to a total of 4 over John Roberts' first 15 years as Chief Justice. Mm. So, you know, we're seeing the court not just – Will was talking about this very specific small slice of the shadow docket. It's actually this other slice that's gotten totally blown up in the last 3 or 4 years, where we're seeing the court being asked to intervene a lot more often. Julie, so far this term, so going back to last October, because the court term runs October to October, the court has changed the status quo in an emergency application 20 times. That's the most ever. It doesn't come close going back historically. Like, last year it was 19, the year before it was 15, the year before it was 7. So, you know, I think what we're seeing is, for reasons that I think are problematic, I mean, because the court is supposed to go last, because there are reasons why the court goes last, you know, all of this effort to sort of front end what are frankly some pretty significant questions, whether it's the CDC eviction moratorium or the Biden administration's effort to rescind the Remain in Mexico immigration policy or the Texas abortion law, where the justices are increasingly, you know, being asked to weigh in so early in the process. And then when they do weigh in, Julie, they're saying so little that it raises enormous concerns about the court's role in our system, but also about transparency when we're not sure exactly what the basis for their rulings are.
Describe for us then what is the process? Do we know what I mean? Because we see some of the work that takes place when the court takes a case and they're going to hear it on the merits. And then there's this deadline and you see all these filings coming in and it's usually a couple months out. And then the hearing happens and there's an hour back and forth. And that may or may not be broadcast, depending on if it's COVID or not. But, you know, but we'll ultimately be able to see transcripts of that at the very least. And then these rulings will come out in which they'll be very long. And sometimes there will be multiple rulings so that justices can kind of explain their justification for the ruling. What exactly do we get when a decision comes down to stay or not stay a law through the shadow docket?
Yeah, I mean, so far as we know, the process is pretty truncated. So, you know, the way the court is supposed to work, these applications are, they go in the first instance to the circuit justice. So each of the 9 justices is assigned to 1 or 2 of the federal appeals courts. And so they get all the applications from the federal courts in that circuit, from the state courts in that circuit. And if it's a sort of, if it's an anodyne case, Julie, if it's an easy case, the justice is supposed to resolve it by themselves. So without even talking to their colleagues. So a good example of this, there was an application last month from 8 students at Indiana University who were trying to get the court to block Indiana University's vaccine mandate. And Justice Barrett denied that application in chamber. She didn't even bother to refer that to the full court. I mean, we don't know because she wrote a sentence, but, you know, I mean, I think the widely held consensus is that the students' claims just weren't sufficiently meritorious.
Mm, okay.
right? That the Seventh Circuit, the federal appeals court that covers Indiana, had written a 4-page opinion, basically giving the students the back of their hand. And I think the general assumption was the Seventh Circuit got it right.
Okay.
So most of these, that's how most of these applications go, right? The most of them are actually not meritorious. The circuit justice denies it by themselves without ever talking to the rest of the court. When it's contentious, when a justice thinks that there's a reasonable probability that at least one of his or her colleagues will dissent or will reach a different decision than that justice, they're supposed to refer it to the full court. But referring it to the full court simply means like sending them a memo saying, we've received this application, I'm inclined to rule this way, here's why. And right there, Julie, we've jumped over so much of the process that happens when the Supreme Court hears a merits case. Right, when the Supreme Court hears a merits case, there are two full rounds of briefing, not just from the parties, but sometimes from dozens of outside interested or less interested groups, right, friends of the court. As you say, there's oral argument, right? The justices meet in person to discuss the case. They don't do that with these. And so the review that the court is conducting is so truncated, both from the perspective of what the parties have the time to argue and from the perspective of how the justices resolve these things behind the scenes. And some of that's by necessity. I mean, so if you have like an execution scheduled for midnight and, you know, you've got to get the decision out by 11 p.m., obviously there's some need to, you know, to hustle. But more and more of these cases, we're not seeing that kind of urgency and we're still seeing this truncated process.
Mm. And when the order is released at 11 p.m. or whatever, does it... They're not required to even like give justification. They can just say yes, no.
So, I mean, this is where I think the shift in the quality of these decisions is really causing so much mischief, Julie, right? That in the old days, right, and indeed still today, for most of these orders, they're anodyne. Or they're obvious. And so there's like, you know, the court, when it denies review, for example, denies certiorari, it never explains why. Mm. You know, when the court denies in the Indiana University case, when Justice Barrett denied that by herself, there's no explanation. Like, that's the norm. And part of why that's true is because, you know, the court, I think, is of the view that it's not worth its time to provide rationale. But the other part of it, Julie, is that the court historically has treated these orders as non-precedential, meaning that anything they say in these orders doesn't have any effect beyond that case. And one of the things that's changed without really any deep introspection from the justices is that the court is now treating at least some of these orders as having precedential effect. So we had, you know, there was a case from California in April where a 5-4 majority issued an emergency injunction to block California's restrictions on in-home gatherings. California had limited in-home gatherings to members of no more than 3 households.
Because of COVID, and because of the pandemic.
Exactly so. And a pastor and another plaintiff challenged the restrictions on the ground that it meant they couldn't have Bible study or religious services in their houses. And 5 of the 9 justices agreed, and they wrote a 4-page opinion explaining why. And at the end of that opinion, Julie, there's this remarkable passage where they say the Ninth Circuit, the federal appeals court in California, has failed to properly, you know, follow our prior decisions in similar cases. And the court cites 4 prior rulings, Julie, all of which were unsigned orders with no explanation.
So it's referring to its own unsigned rulings that are not technically supposed to be precedent, but they're using them as precedent. The court was in
exactly
that case.
Exactly. And so if you are a responsible lower court judge, if you're a responsible state or federal official, right? I mean, if your job is not to have an agenda, it's simply to parse what the Supreme Court is saying and do your best to follow it. What do you do with that? And I think that's the thread that ties all of these concerns together. It would be one thing if the court were issuing more of these decisions, but they weren't having an impact beyond those cases. But they are having impacts. I mean, the Texas abortion case is a really good example of this. Like, by not intervening, the court allowed, you know, the most restrictive anti-abortion law since Roe to go into effect in the nation's second largest state. That's, whatever you think of abortion, that's an enormous deal. And, you know, the eviction moratorium is the same way, right? The court blocked the eviction moratorium in a way that effectively killed it. And so as these rulings are having such broad real-world effects, and the court is not doing very much to explain them, and the court's not following its normal process, and the court is treating these not very well-explained rulings as having precedential effect that binds lower courts and parties, You know, it's when you add those things together that I think you really start to see why at least folks like me have started to see this as such an area of concern.
Speaking with Stephen Vladeck, who is a professor at the University of Texas School of Law, he's written about the shadow docket and other processes of the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court. Have any of the justices themselves on the Supreme Court expressed any concern about this trend that they seem to be caught up in as a court?
Yeah, so two have. I mean, so Justice Sotomayor, about a year and a half ago, actually almost 2 years now, wrote a dissent in an immigration case where she accused the majority of being too willing to grant emergency relief for the Trump administration. And that was a more specific complaint about who was asking for the relief. And the data backs it up to some degree. I mean, the Trump administration sought emergency relief from the Supreme Court 41 times in 4 years. Between them, the Bush and Obama administrations across 16 years had asked for such relief 8 times. So that's a 20-fold increase. And the court had acquiesced. The court had granted 28 of those 41 requests in whole or in part. So Justice Sotomayor criticized her colleagues for being too deferential to the federal government. The first real sort of broad-based criticism actually came from Justice Kagan in the Texas abortion case, where she accused the majority of increasingly using the shadow docket not just to hand down major rulings, but to hand down major rulings that are, in her words, unexplained and inconsistent. And I think those are, you know, as usual for Justice Kagan, I mean, I think she cuts right to the heart of the matter, which is it would be one thing if the court was, you know, explaining itself and being consistent. But when you add those two things together, that they're not always explaining themselves, that the explanations they're providing are relatively truncated and cryptic, and that they're being inconsistent in some pretty significant ways, I think that's where you start to see why, you know, even Justice Kagan, who's not usually one to go out of her way to criticize her colleagues, decided to use this particular case to call out this practice.
But if the court had decided to block the Texas abortion law, can you see Justice Kagan being critical of the process? I mean, it seems like this is so much about which way it falls. And if you're in the minority and the majority is, you know, using this tool to stay or not stay in an emergency, then, of course, you're not happy with it. But if it goes your way, then it's working just like it should be, because that's the point of emergency stays, is to stop bad things from happening. Right.
So it is a common response to critics like me that we must just not be happy with the results. And I totally understand why that's folks' reaction, but I think that grossly deserves the importance of procedural regularity. And so let's just take the inconsistency charge. So in the Texas abortion case, right, what the majority said in the paragraph and a half of analysis it provided was that there were these open procedural questions about the kind of relief the plaintiffs were seeking that really made it inappropriate to issue emergency relief in that context. And even if the merits were clear, as I think everyone thinks they are, that the procedural questions the court would have to resolve were reason enough to not intervene. So, Julie, in the abstract, like 5 years ago, right, that ruling would have made all the sense in the world. But when you measure it against what the court has been doing and when it has been intervening, I mean, we mentioned a few minutes ago this April case from California about the in-home gathering restrictions during COVID. You know, in that case, Julie, the exact same 5-4 majority blew right past not a procedural question, but a procedural obstacle, which is that they're not supposed to issue relief in that context if the rights aren't already clear. And in that case, the majority articulated a new principle of free exercise clause jurisprudence, of religious liberty jurisprudence, that, you know, we might like or we might not like. But the procedural obstacle to using that case to make new law was just no, never mind. And so this is where I think, you know, saying that the, you know, those who are criticizing the shadow docket are just pissed off at the results, I think misses the point that the charge of inconsistency is really a serious one. And, you know, just to sort of drive the point home, I mean, the person who started all of this, like, I blame him, right? Professor Bode, clerk for Chief Justice Roberts, and is no one's definition of a liberal. So, you know, folks who are, even sort of folks who are less, I think, identified with particular ideological approaches to the Supreme Court and to the Supreme Court's interpretive commitments, you know, I think have found serious issues with what the court's doing, and for good reason.
What could the court do instead? Because they're going to continue to get asked, and they've already sort of established this precedent. Is there any way to kind of incrementally right the ship? If you are a conservative majority and you do think that you know, that you'd like to let the Texas law stand on abortion. Yeah. Would there be a way to also, though, kind of signal that this deserves more attention by the court later down the line?
Sure. I mean, I think the court could have done a lot more than write a paragraph and a half. Indeed, one of the things that the court could have done, and I'm surprised it didn't do, is they could have taken the emergency application and treated it as a petition for plenary review and granted it and said, you know what, this is a hard, important case. We're going to take it and we're going to actually give it the full review it deserves. They did that, for example, Julie, in the second travel ban cases in 2017.
Where they say, okay, there's a lot going on here. In 2 months, we're going to have a hearing on this.
Exactly. And in fact, this is not that, I mean, literally the last emergency order we got from the Supreme Court last Wednesday was granting a stay of execution in a case arising out of here from Texas about whether a death row inmate was allowed to have his spiritual advisor in the execution chamber with him and whether his advisor is allowed to pray with him and touch him. Mm. And Julie, the court didn't just grant the stay. It granted the stay, said we're going to take this case up on the merits and put it on the argument docket for November. Hmm. That's not hard. So I would like to see the court do more of that. I would also think it would behoove all of us for the court to do more than give us a paragraph of explanation in these cases, especially if they're going to treat these orders as precedential. And I think if the court commits to those two practices alone, that would be an enormous salutary improvement, because just having to write more, I think, will expose some of the problems here. We'll make it easier to justify requiring lower courts to treat these rulings as precedential when there's actually analysis that the lower courts can, you know, defer to.
Stephen Vladeck is a professor at the University of Texas School of Law, an expert in how the Supreme Court works and the role of the shadow docket. Thank you very much for your time today, Professor.
Thank you, Julie.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, what your preference for waking up early or sleeping late says about your personality. Just ahead, how can a powerful man sexually harass women at work and have that be just an open secret nobody does anything about? It is good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Julie Rose. When a powerful person is found to have sexually harassed someone in his professional circles, there are always people who witnessed or were told of it and kept silent. The New York Attorney General's investigation of former Governor Andrew Cuomo highlights numerous top officials in Cuomo's office, most of them women, who protected the governor and even threatened women who reported being harassed by him. Jennifer Birdall is a social psychologist who studies why silence is so often the norm in workplaces where harassment happens. Birdall is a professor at the University of British Columbia, and she's on the line. Welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Julie.
When one of these cases comes to light, like with Governor Cuomo, people always ask, why didn't the victims and the witnesses speak up? But you argue in your work that people do speak up. It's what happens after that's the problem. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So it's not that people don't say anything or see anything. It's that they are silenced when they do speak up. And, you often hear that sexual harassment is about power. You know, what does that mean? Well, we know that it means from research that harassers harass other people because they want to assert power over them. I mean, they literally sort of get off on dominating the victim or get a rise out of controlling or humiliating somebody. But we also know it's about power because the harasser gets away with it because they have the power to do this. And that power is almost always social power. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes economic. You know, the harasser might be able to fire or demote or evict somebody to coerce them into silence. It also might be physical. They might be stronger than the victim, and they might be able to overpower and intimidate them. But it's almost always social power when they get away with it in this kind of open, secret, professional environment. And that social power looks like others who depend on the harasser and are connected to the harasser in a professional and other sense that gives the harasser power over them. So even the women who were protecting Andrew Cuomo were subject to his power, right? He could fire them at will, and they were carrying out his orders and his wishes to protect him.
Hmm. So is it your conclusion then that this kind of unfortunate situation is most likely to occur when the harasser is at the center of the wheel, you know, the power of that individual, and it's usually a man, kind of connects everybody and everything?
Yeah, absolutely. So our research and some others show that the harasser is at the center of the network typically, or are very central players. That means that they have more connections than other people to others within that professional network setting. Mm. They have stronger connections. So, we find that these networks tend to be dominated numerically by men who might go golfing with each other or, you know, might know each other's family. So those connections are very strong. Mm. They're numerous. And they can also isolate victims from each other. So, you know, in some of the cases I've worked on, women are harassed, but they don't realize there are other victims because they're disconnected in the network from those other victims.
How does that disconnection happen? What is the business structure where a woman would not know that there are other women maybe sitting in cubicles not far from her who are experiencing the same thing?
Right. Well, I mean, that's where silence plays a big role when it's a hush about it. I apologize. There's a phone call trying to come in here.
Old-fashioned call waiting. I never could remember how that works. Sorry, but you did just cut out very briefly. So so that's how the silence happens, you mentioned.
Yeah, so the silence prevents them from finding out that there are other victims, and the silencing, the act of silencing that we saw, especially in the Cuomo case, but also the Weinstein case and other famous cases. Mm-hmm. But there's also the fact that they're outnumbered. You know, they tend to be lower in rank in the organization, so they may not be working directly with one another, and they might mm-hmm. be outnumbered by others with strong ties to the perpetrator who silence them and prevent them from talking to each other even.
So that's the isolation where if you have fewer women in a work environment, and
yes.
if they don't have reason to be frequently interacting with each other, that's the isolation that you're talking about.
Yeah,
you know, if they're like the only woman on their team or the only woman in their department or one of very few.
Yeah, and because the harasser has such power over the reputations of others in that environment, they can smear, you know, a woman who might complain about it and say she's crazy or don't believe her. Mm. And then others will avoid talking to her or, you know, being associated with her. Even other victims or other future victims.
Yeah. So, Professor Birdall, not all men are sexual harassers. Not all men are sympathetic to sexual harassment. So why would having stronger relationships, I want to go back to what you were saying about a situation where the harasser has more and stronger relationships with people, with lots of people in an organization. Why would a man who goes golfing with the harasser regularly be any more willing to, you know, like be okay with sexual harassment?
Well, he might not necessarily know about the sexual harassment if he's golfing with the perpetrator. Mm. It's not like the perpetrator necessarily talks about it. But he also might be more willing to give him the benefit of the doubt if he's a personal friend and see it from his perspective. So that perspective might involve, it's no big deal what happened, she's exaggerating if he finds out, or, you know, she asked for it, it's something she wanted, et cetera. So he's more inclined to see it through the eyes of the perpetrator if he's friends with that perpetrator.
You also, in your research, talk about some cultural, I guess, beliefs, ways of looking at this issue that can make a workplace more susceptible to a culture of silence around harassment.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so those cultural beliefs that sort of permeate these networks of silence, as we call them, involve valorizing masculinity. So it could be a profession or, you know, a social network in which masculine heroes tend to dominate the narrative, and that you know, masculinity itself is really esteemed and valorized. So this kind of boys will be boys behavior or joking around or even sexually objectifying new women hired into the organization is just commonplace. Mm. And so to the extent that that behavior is valorized, it's tolerated. And it's kind of the soil in which sexual harassment can grow. And then the other one are sexual harassment myths. So those usually involve denying that the harassment occurred or that it was any big deal at all. And if that can't be denied, then blaming the victim for what happened. So basically suggesting that she had it coming or she asked for it in some way or she deserved the treatment that she got.
Mm. So if you have all of these components that you've outlined, how would the situation play out? Give me sort of a hypothetical, or maybe it's a real world example that we know about where, let's say there are several women in an organization who have experienced sexual harassment, you know, inappropriate or too intimate conversation from this man in power. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's just like flirtation that makes them very uncomfortable, comments about their body that make them uncomfortable. Maybe it's more overt than that. What would be the most likely scenario in a situation where a couple of women are experiencing that in an organization like you described?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll use another type of example because we're talking about, you know, these famous ones. But one that is famous, at least in Canada, is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So police organizations are often sites where this kind of behavior occurs. Mm. And that's an organization where men have typically run everything and definitely outnumbered women. So women would come in as new recruits. They'd be isolated or there'd be very few of them at their posts. So a single woman might experience, you know, anything from a sex-based slur to, you know, outright sexual assault. But, you know, the other men in the detachment, even if they don't approve of it, are still dependent upon the guy who does it, or they're friends with him, or they just, there's sort of this code of conduct where you don't rat each other out. You kind of circle the wagons, and so she starts getting marginalized, and her mental health might even start to decline as a result of this horrible treatment she's experiencing, in which case they can also say she's crazy, you know, if they want to, or she doesn't come to work on a regular basis or she's unreliable. And then imagine this happening across the country in these detachments, and these women don't know about each other, and there's no one to tell. Like if they have to report it, they have to report it to somebody who's very strongly connected to the perpetrator or is the perpetrator themselves. And so this is a real case that happened where Janet Merlo was the leading member of a class action suit, and she was dismissed as crazy and all the other things that you can imagine they would say about her. And then another woman came forward and another, and pretty soon we had over 300 women, and then it got into the thousands of women who were saying, this happened to me. And it's the largest single settlement that's occurred in Canada in a sexual harassment lawsuit as a result. But it was an open secret. You know, everybody knew that this kind of, you know, banter and name-calling and treatment of women was just part of the culture. But nobody did anything about it.
Mm. And after the fact, did you see, you know, men in the organization saying, yeah, this is terrible. This should never have happened. Like sort of regretting or realizing that, you know, explaining why they didn't say anything?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just like the women who are protecting Cuomo, you know, there are men who might not even be actively protecting the perpetrator, but they're also caught in this web of complicity or this web of silence where they are scared to speak out. And sexual harassment almost always co-occurs with just general bullying in an organization. So men were also victims of bullying within this police organization, and men were also victims of bullying for Cuomo and Weinstein and others, right? Mm. These are sort of personalities that tend to thrive in these organizational environments that harm men and women alike.
What structural changes could an organization make proactively to reduce the chances that this might occur in their own ranks?
Well, other than, you know, not tolerating this behavior and getting rid of people who engage in it.
In terms of like the culture of, you know, sexual jokes or misogyny, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, one of the things is obviously you have more women present in positions of power. It's probably not going to go over as well if women are equals within the organization to make derogatory jokes about them. You can strengthen intersex network ties, too. That is, you can, you know, not make it a boys' club where, you know, promotions and opportunities are gained on the golf course, but it's something where men and women socialize kind of like brothers and sisters in a respectful way, and everybody kind of has the same information and opportunities.
Can I ask about that, drill down for just a moment? How do you encourage, I remember after the Me Too, you know, kind of in the height of the Me Too movement a couple of years ago, I heard a lot of men very sincerely say, you know, look, I recognize that I don't invite the women on my team to go to lunch or to, you know, to play golf with me regularly because I feel like I could, you know, I don't know what that's going to open me up to. Like, how do I, you know, I feel like I might end up, I'm not going to develop closer ties with the women on my team because I might get accused of sexual harassment for saying the wrong thing. How does an organization encourage these intersex ties, given that men may feel like that?
Well, that's going to take some myth-busting, because what he's basically parroting there is just a straight-up myth that women lie about sexual harassment. You know, very, very few women lie about sexual harassment. It's incredibly rare. The repercussions and consequences to a woman of complaining about sexual harassment are usually worse than the harassment itself, so very, very few women ever make a formal complaint, let alone lie about it. So, you know, busting that kind of a myth and narrative within the organization that you can't trust those women, you know, they're going to blackmail you if you go out to lunch with them.
What if it's just appearances, though? It's just like, okay, so two married individuals, a man and a woman, having a one-on-one lunch together. Do I feel like that's okay versus me taking, you know, a guy on my team out to work if I'm a man?
Well, again, I guess that's the social perceptions of the people within the organization. Mm-hmm. If those kinds of rumors are going to promulgate, that's also a heterosexist assumption, right? Yeah. Two men could be going out to lunch together and having an affair as well.
Yeah. So some of that then is establishing, I guess what you're saying is establishing and normalizing mentorships between men and women. And, you know, if there's like some sort of extracurricular thing that happens that builds team building, you got to make sure everybody's involved in that or has equal opportunity to be part of that.
That's a good way to put it, yes.
What else?
Structural holes between women.
What does that mean, closing structural holes?
Well, giving, that's an academic term. So this idea that women are marginalized or isolated within a network, making sure that that doesn't happen, you know, so that there's not this pattern where one group of people is kind of isolated and alone and doesn't have the opportunity to talk to each other. So you could have you know, a reporting mechanism where victims are connected. One way that some organizations have approached this is through a reporting system where a woman can report but not be investigated or nothing be done about it until another one reports, or perhaps three report, right? So that they know that it is strength in numbers and she's not the only one. And that's one way to close those structural holes or the isolation that occurs between women so that they can not really have to put themselves out alone on that branch until there are other women who have joined them. And when you have a serial harasser, it's always the tip of the iceberg, right, when one woman reports it.
Jennifer Birtle is a professor of sociology at the University of British Columbia. Thanks a lot for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Julie.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, what your preference for waking up early or sleeping late says about your personality. It's great to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. Morning people are more likely to be conscientious. Night people tend to be more open to new experiences. Why would sleep patterns have anything to do with personality? Anu Realo is a psychology professor who studies how genetics affect personality, and she's on the line from the University of Warwick in England to talk about some of these new findings. Professor Realo, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk very specifically about some of these personality traits first. When we say conscientiousness, a morning person is more likely to be conscientious. What is conscientiousness?
So conscientiousness is one of the big five personality traits. And conscientious people are usually very punctual, well-organized, or, you know, when we have to do something, they do this. Or exactly as we are supposed to do this, and so on and so forth. So it's one of the traits which is also strongly related to all sorts of good things, like conscientious people are more engaged in health-related behaviours, and it's a good trait to have. Hmm. So people with low conscientiousness would, you know, do the opposite. So they would be late, they wouldn't do things when we are supposed to do these things, or we are not so well organized, and so on and so forth, not so self-disciplined.
So how are you defining morning person? Is this somebody who wakes up punctually when their alarm goes off, or is it someone who wakes up early happily, like they want to be up in the morning?
It's more like people who we say are morning people are more likely to get up early in the morning. And earlier in the morning and go to bed earlier. And evening people are, you know, on the other hand, they are more likely to stay up later in the evening and also sleep longer in the morning. We aim to measure this on weekends or 3 days because this is when people can do what they want to do. Mm. Because our lives are so strongly affected by social requirements because, you know, We have to
get up and go to work. Right?
We have to work. You know, we have to send kids after school. Yeah. You know, we have to do all sorts of things. I think very few of us can, you know, we can do this during certain periods of our life, you know, because when we're retired, we can see, you know, how people's sort of like, you know, sleep timings change simply because, you know, they don't have to go to work anymore and so on and so forth. So we try to measure people's natural sort of like inclinations. What is it they want to do? And we know that it differs across the lifespan for most people.
Okay. In what way then?
It's also quite obvious because, you know, anyone who's seen young babies, you know, they know that, you know, they tend to get up quite early in the morning, and this is exactly how it goes. So our young babies and toddlers, especially, you know, these crazy 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, you know, they wake up super early in the morning, but this changes as they grow up, and I'd say it reaches its peak during adolescence. And sometimes people even say that it's sort of like when young adolescents slowly start to become more morning people, it indicates the end of adolescence because adolescents, they like to sleep in, you know, in the morning but it changes again as we get older.
And Professor Realo, why ask the question of how sleep patterns connects to personality? Are you suggesting that being a night owl also like changes your personality, shapes your personality in some way?
We kind of propose that it's your personality which to some extent determines whether you are a morning person or an evening person. But of course, we don't know for sure. It's absolutely possible that they are mutually sort of influencing each other, or it's possible that, you know, this sort of chronotype thing comes first and it has an impact on our personality.
And chronotype, so when you say chronotype, that's your sleep schedule. That's your... whether you're a night owl or an early bird.
Yeah, chronotype is just another way to express, sleep timing. When is it when people go to bed?
Okay.
And when is it we wake up? Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So in one explanation, if you are the kind of person who's open to new experiences, you like excitement, well, it would make sense that you'd want to be out at night because that's when a lot of the interesting stuff is going on. Therefore, you become a night person.
Oh, absolutely. And this is exactly what we proposed as one of the possible explanations for the relationship between sleep timings, aka chronotype, and personality traits. Mm. So it's possible that, as you said, you know, people who are open to new experiences, you know, they crave for excitement, all sorts of new things, you know, they love, going out, to enjoy some performances and all sorts of things. So we know that openness is related to all sorts of things. You know, you are interested in arts and music, you like reading books and all sorts of things. And of course, you know, many of these cultural activities, you know, they happen late at night. Mm. So this kind of makes sense. So this is one of the this is one of the explanations. But it's also possible that our personality may influence sleep timings through active decisions people make regarding their sleep. So, as I said, conscientiousness is one of the B5 personality traits, which is strongly related to health and health-related behavior. So, it may well be that, you know, sort of disciplined or conscientious people, or they sort of make deliberate decisions to go to bed earlier as part of healthier lifestyle sort of routine. Mm.
So people who are night owls, who tend to go to bed later, wake up later, that correlates to worse health compared to the morning people?
Yeah, but we didn't show it in our research, but other people have shown this, that it is indeed, it's being a morning person seems to be better for your health. But it's possible to train yourself into a different, more socially convenient sleep pattern, simply by sort of increasing your level of self-control and self-discipline. But I have to be very, very careful about it because I think we need future studies to see if this is actually possible. If such interventions, you know, to enhance self-control would actually result in a change of chronotype, because so far I'd say the research is kind of ambiguous about this. If you force yourself to do this, in the end you may not benefit from this because as I said, chronotype and sleep timings, you know, they also they're related to your sort of like genetic predispositions and circadian rhythms and all sorts of other things. So I'd be very careful to claim that you can force yourself to become a morning person, even if it's related to all sorts of health benefits. Mm.
So you might be waking up in the morning, but you're still a night person, fundamentally,
yes,
like your
yes,
body,
absolutely.
Your circadian rhythm.
Absolutely, yes. But I think small sort of modifications to your sleep schedule are definitely worth trying.
And so how much of your sleep timing patterns are genetic? Can we say that it's 50% genetic and 50%?
Yeah, it's about 50-60% both for okay. sleep timings and personality traits.
Okay. Oh, and personality traits. Okay.
Yes, and personality traits.
Both are about 50% genetic. And so that explains...
Yeah, roughly 50-60% genetic.
Yeah. Which explains why it's difficult to change your personality or change your sleep timing preferences.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's not 100%, which is important to emphasize.
Yeah.
So it's just 50-60%. And this is what we know now.
Would you list off for us then the personality traits that seem to correlate most with being a morning person? We've talked about conscientiousness. Is there anything else?
Yes, it's conscientiousness, and it's also openness to experience, meaning that people who have low levels of openness to experience seem to be morning persons. And when we talk about specific sort of like narrower personality traits, it's self-discipline. It's one of the facets of conscientiousness, which is strongly related with early chronotype, and also excitement seeking, which is one of the facets of extraversion. So, and as the name says, you know, people who have high levels of excitement seeking, they are actively seeking new experiences, you know, they want to try out different new things.
Those are the night, that correlates with night people.
Yes. Yeah, well, but it basically says that if people have low levels of excitement seeking, they tend to be morning people.
Okay, so it's just the flip side. So if you're a night person, you tend to be less conscientious and more open to new experiences, more excitement seeking. And the
Absolutely.
Reverse is true if you're a morning person.
Yes, because when we talk about personality traits, we talk about dimensions. So on the one hand, we would have like low levels of extraversion, and on the other hand, we have high levels of extraversion, and the same goes for conscientiousness and all of our personality traits.
Anu Arialo is a professor of psychology at the University of Warwick in England. She's also president of the European Association of Personality Psychology. Thank you for taking time to talk with us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First, this hour, the return of the radio drama. Then, why scientists who work with lab rats are encouraged to regularly play with their research subjects. It's called rat tickling. You can even get a certification in it. Also, next time you're in line on a bus or in the elevator, look up from your phone and talk to a stranger. We'll explain why and how. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for joining us. There was a time in America, before every home had a television, when radio was the heart of home entertainment. Lots of big Hollywood stars had lively careers starring in radio dramas, often as the same characters that they made famous on the silver screen. Radio dramas became less popular as TV gained its grip upon us, but now they're coming back thanks to the rise of podcasting. And The Appleseed, a podcast produced by BYU Radio, is getting in on the action in some fun ways. And so we've got Sam Payne in the studio to talk about it. He's the host of The Appleseed. Hey there, Sam. Welcome.
It's great to be here and to talk about radio dramas. This
is
kind of
so fun. When I was about 10, my dad brought home a bag, like a canvas library bag full of radio drama cassette tapes that he had checked out at the library. And I listened to The Green Hornet every single night and wore those tapes out. We probably had to pay the library for them because I thought this was such a novel and amusing thing that there were these little mini, like 10-minute I don't know, movies, yeah. Like audio movies. And this is like in the 1980s. So it was like well past, you know, the era. And kind of, there was kind of this like old timiness to it that I thought was quite amusing. Yeah. Did radio dramas play at all into your childhood?
First of all, I imagine you listening to The Green Hornet. And it's, even though those were made a long time ago, it's this completely gripping experience.
Yeah.
You know?
It's detective stories.
It's incredible. And, yeah. You know, my first experience with radio drama was when I was 10 years old. Mm. It was kind of a magical time, right? Mm-hmm. It's 1981, and we had this kind of destination listening engagement. Every week, my dad would set up the little radio that we had on top of the refrigerator in the kitchen so that we could eat dinner together. And while we were eating dinner, listen to the NPR serialized radio drama version of Star Wars.
Star Wars?
Yeah.
Luke Skywalker, Leia,
everybody.
Han
Solo. Yeah. And it was kind of incredible.
This is like,
you know,
not that long after the first Star Wars actually came out.
That's
even.
Right. Yeah. That would have been 1977. And in 1981, people were kind of hankering for it, right? And and it was still the days. I mean, there was plenty of television, of course. But what there wasn't was a way to watch movies at home. And, you know, in those days, we were going down to the video rental store and renting VHS tapes.
And the VCR.
The VCR, right?
To bring home. Yeah.
So it was still a little bit tricky to watch exactly what you wanted. And so the notion of being able to hear that story, the Star Wars story, played out as an audio drama was really exciting. It had a couple of the actors from the original films.
Really?
Mark Hamill played Luke Skywalker. Anthony Daniels played C-3PO. But everybody else was
different.
But it
was like it wasn't just the audio of the movie that they had kind of like ripped off.
Right.
This was...
Built
it was a
for
different
radio.
Script built for radio.
Yeah. And of course, it was 13 half-hour episodes.
Whoa.
So it was, you know, it was much longer than
a lot
the movie
more
Star
than
Wars.
You got in that one movie.
Yeah,
and
was great.
George Lucas okay with all of this?
The cool thing about this story is that it was produced by an NPR affiliate at a college. Hmm. And the college happened to be George Lucas's alma mater.
Oh no.
And so he let the rights to all of the material and all of the music and everything go for a dollar. Kind of famous.
That is
for
amazing.
$1, so.
I can't. Are these out there? Can you listen? Can you find them like on YouTube or something?
You can find them. And if you're if you're this kind of person, as I am, you can find copies of those things like on CD and things like that on eBay and things like that. But yeah, you can still find it around. But it was this kind of splash back into the audio drama world, you know.
Right.
While your folks are bringing home library cassettes of The Green Hornet, you know, this is actually being produced in 1981 for 1981 audiences. It was really exciting for us.
Well, you brought a clip for us, so let's listen to a quick clip of one of these episodes.
I'm all right. I'm hit. They got R2.
The Death Star is nearly in range.
Their leader's right on my back. There's nothing I can do. What? Somebody's firing on them. Han?
Okay. You're all clear, kid.
Han, I knew you.
I was totally imagining how were they doing the spaceship dogfights and
right,
how were they?
Yeah. And so you get Mark Hamill saying things like, no, someone's firing on us.
You know, like 1980s Atari sound effects.
Han Solo played not by Harrison Ford. Yeah, but by a television actor who was one of the stars of the old TV show Riptide about the couple of Vietnam vets who fought crime from their helicopter and lived on a boat.
Okay, so Sam Payne, give us a bit of the history here. 1980, as we've both established, this was kind of a throwback to have this kind of thing going on.
Yeah.
When was the peak, the golden age of radio drama?
You know, radio dramas go almost all the way back to the beginning of radio, right? But in the 1920s, they started bringing to the air dramatized or audio performances of Broadway plays, right? Or audio performances of pieces of literature or Shakespeare plays.
Where people would just kind of read, you know, some good British voice would
read
Oliver Twist or something. Like audiobooks almost.
That's right.
Or soundtracks.
Right.
You know, like you can get like the Hamilton Broadway soundtrack, which is basically all the lines in the music.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it was very much like that.
Okay.
And then by the 30s, then you're getting getting, especially in America, stuff that's written for radio. Then we're getting things like these serialized detective dramas and stuff like that. In the UK, it was different. In the UK, they were still doing Shakespeare performances and literary performances, M.R. James ghost stories and things like that, you know. And that was kind of the vibe and the tone of what was going on in the UK.
But America, it was more Hollywood.
Yeah, very much.
And so you would have, I mean, who was doing these radio dramas? Would it have been the movie studios who were also kind of like extending their screen property?
Sure, there would be a connection there, right? But it was the radio companies who were producing these things, and they were being produced by, and as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, they were often versions of films that were big on the big screen, starring the same stars. So you've got Jimmy Stewart and Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall and Cary Grant and all these folks reprising roles for the radio that they'd made famous on the screen.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get a taste of that. I think you've brought one for us. And interestingly, we should note that the Appleseed, in addition to doing some of its own original radio dramas, which we'll talk about in a moment, you're also you've obtained the rights to air some of these classic dramas.
Yeah,
so
it's
what have you
so
got
exciting.
For us?
This is a radio drama, famously Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, who had played Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson in countless films based on Sherlock Holmes stories. Reprised those roles on the radio in The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. This is from a mystery called The Adventure of the Speckled Band. And again, these movie and radio stars, Nigel Bruce and Basil Rathbone as Dr. Watson and Sherlock Holmes. Here's Sherlock Holmes.
When we get your signal, Dr. Watson and I will come here and spend the night in your dead sister's room. We are going to solve this mystery of the dummy bell rope and the unusual ventilator and the strange music in the night.
And scene.
That's right.
And turn the page now.
That's right.
And the music.
There are a couple of things about that clip that I love. And first of all, you get the ubiquitous organ punctuation, right?
Yeah.
That's in everything. Everybody's using the organ to punctuate all these mysteries, right? Which is so great. And then the other thing you get is right at the beginning of that clip, you may have heard Basil Rathbone as Sherlock Holmes kind of stuttering a little bit, tripping over his lines a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty common too, you know. They're clearly reading these parts, and sometimes they didn't go back and fix some of those things. You know, you get these little flubs every once in a while. That's really kind of charming.
And you get the sort of we're now narrating what's going to happen next, because
that's right.
We would on the screen just show you that we are now setting up camp in the dead woman's room.
That's right. And they're such products of their time, you know. The way the Sherlock Holmes pieces, for example, are set up is Dr. Watson comes to explain to the radio host the case that they were on, you know.
Yeah.
And at the end of the episode, you're going to hear, you know, you're going to hear Nigel Bruce as Dr. Watson pitching war bonds, you know, during this war era radio experience.
Of the moment.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Okay. And you would, of course, have advertising in between, I imagine,
oh,
you know, for
like crazy.
Lots of jingles. And and then at a certain point, when do they start to kind of die out in terms of popularity or start to be produced in fewer numbers?
Well, in this country, television really sort of brought about the demise of the radio drama. You
50s know, and
television
60s.
Comes along in the 50s, and by the 60s, we're not really making radio dramas anymore.
Just because there's no interest, or like who sits around there? Like that's it's so old.
Yeah, people
if we can sit around and watch the Bob Hope show or whatever,
right.
Like
people are watching television rather than listening to radio in that way, right?
Okay.
But it doesn't take the same trajectory in the UK and sort of across the Atlantic. They're still making radio dramas, and they are to this day. I mean, that's a tradition that has gone on in some ways sort of unbroken.
Is that because they have the BBC, which is, you know, this sort of like juggernaut of radio that is publicly funded? And
yeah,
so
maybe so. They've retained this interest, you know. So for us in America nowadays, there's this kind of renaissance of the radio drama when, it's been this kind of unbroken string across the pond.
Right.
Across the pond.
And so let's draw the distinction then as podcasting – because radios continued to be around. And you could even see little pieces of this in some of the, you know, like a Prairie Home Companion would do little mini radio dramas, things like that. Occasionally, you'd get a local public radio station that would do a dramatic reading. I mean, BYU Radio's even had like the Christmas Chronicles, which is sort of this fictional telling of Santa's origin story.
Right.
So that's always been, you know, we've had little bits of that around, usually through public radio broadcasts. Yeah. But when podcasting starts up, it's not initially radio dramas. It seems like it's really more, you know, talk shows or like documentary or investigation, serialized true crime stories.
Right.
Like Serial was one of the big first podcasts to kind of go super viral. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
And that remains the case. That has taken hold and is there's a very rich life for that kind of stuff.
Right.
But what you have now is you've got equipment, recording and editing equipment so easily available to every person who, as a little girl, parents brought home cassettes of the Green Hornet from the library.
Yep.
So now you've got that generation of people who were captivated by that at one time in their lives, who are now able to sort of do it from home.
Right.
You know? And the barrier to entry is so low that people can kind of produce this stuff sort of wherever they are.
But there's a difference between, because, you know, Audible, lots of people listen to books on tape.
Yeah.
And the radio drama, in what ways is it even different from that? Different from even the traditional storytelling, you know, kinds of audio that the Appleseed has been putting on the air for years now.
Yeah, I think there really is. I mean, certainly there are all kinds of innovations in the kind of radio storytelling that's going on now. If you listen to some of the radio dramas that are being produced now, they are they're very distant descendants of the Green Hornet and Sherlock Holmes and things like that. But a lot of the storytelling principles are the very same. A lot of the things that they're trying to achieve are that very same kind of intimate experience that people were having with some of that old stuff. So again, while there are a lot of innovations being made, it really is this really – what I think is this really wonderful kind of compelling look back at our roots as radio.
Yeah,
programs.
Interesting. So are we? I mean, I'm certainly familiar, and we should talk for a moment about the kinds of things like the Treasure Island 2020 podcast that the Appleseed did, nominated for a Peabody, really cool, which was an entire season.
Right.
It was one story told over 10 parts.
Yeah, that's right. 10 half-hour episodes.
Something like the Green Hornet was. Here's your intrepid detective for this week's drama, right? It's more like the serial detective shows that we see some of, you know, it's like CSI, right? Where every week they solve a new case.
Right.
Are we seeing more the kind of like season-long arc type stuff or the more of one-offs?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of both. We're seeing these sort of serialized, sometimes they last seasons and seasons and seasons, you know, episodes and episodes and episodes that unfold a single story over many episodes. But we're also seeing these single stories. We're producing some of them as the Appleseed. We're producing single 15-minute stories with a beginning, middle, and an end for just one little radio experience. That, of course, has its roots in the golden age of radio, too. But it's really exciting for us to write these little 15-minute scripts and enjoy producing them.
What's the challenge of writing and producing a radio drama? How's that different?
Well, you know, you heard in that Star Wars clip, you know, the necessity to spell everything out because you can't see anything, right? And that for a lot of writers and a lot of performers is a difficulty too. And that's really the biggest the biggest difference between writing for radio and any other kind of writing, right?
Yeah.
Is you've got to build everything into the dialogue and sound effects so that everything is spelled out, so that the entire story is spelled out.
So the listener can follow along, but so that it doesn't feel like you're interrupting the action every 10 seconds to explain, we're now moving upstairs.
Yeah. Or jump in with a narrator that says, in the corner, a dark figure sits with a Guinness.
Let's listen to a couple of examples. So I mentioned Treasure Island 2020, which is still available on the Appleseed podcast.
Sure. You can find it at BYUradio.org. You can look there for Treasure Island 2020 and find all 10 episodes. This is just a little clip, just a little moment from that. We called it a time-traveling, swashbuckling adventure based on Robert Louis Stevenson's, novel written in the 1880s.
Billy! 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 I've got you. You're gonna be okay, Billy.
The treasure. Find the treasure island.
But where is it?
Not where, lad. When?
The pirate Billy Bones after actually having been hit by a car in 2020.
Pretty fun stuff.
That's right.
Fun so, for the whole family. Yeah. And so you mentioned that you're doing also some, now the latest thing is some little shorter episodes, standalone dramas.
That's right.
What, 20, 30 minutes long.
Yeah, yeah. And I brought a little clip of one of them. This is the story of a family that wins basically a robot maid, and mayhem ensues. And in this clip, they're getting to know the cleaning capabilities of this android.
This is so cool.
Vacuum complete. Let's be friends.
Wow, that was fast.
I think she likes us.
What? No! She's a machine!
She understands verbal commands? Ah, the glory
Derek,
of winning!
Why are you putting my sweater on the floor? Excuse me!
Trust me, sis.
That is so... Mom!
Sweater cleansing complete.
There's a voice, of course, among those voices that listeners may say, hey, you know, that sounds a lot like Julie Rose, only because it absolutely is Julie Rose. We were,
that was
partly
little...
why I brought that clip. Oh. It's so fun to have had you as part of our wonderful cast.
Yeah, it was a fun little project. So where can people find these new radio dramas?
People can find them inserted into episodes of The Appleseed that plays just about every day. These will come to you on Fridays, generally. Okay. The Appleseed plays from 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And you can also find them at byuradio.org/Appleseed.
Or where you get your podcast.
Or wherever you
just
get your podcast.
Just look for The Appleseed.
That's right.
Sam Payne, host of The Appleseed, a storytelling podcast. Thanks a lot for your time. I'm excited about radio dramas.
Oh, we are too. Always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks, Julie.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, next time you're in line, on a bus, or in the elevator, look up from your phone and talk to a stranger. We'll explain why you should do that. Also, just ahead, rat tickling, how to do it, and why you'd want to. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Tickle me and you are liable to get a black eye. I do not like being tickled. But rats apparently love it. Well, lab rats, anyway. And you can even get a certificate in the art of proper rat tickling from Purdue University. Brianna Gaskill helped create that program while she was a professor at Purdue. She's recently gone to work as an animal welfare specialist at the drug company Novartis. And she is with us now to talk a bit about rat tickling and how it works. Brianna Gaskill, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Julie. I'm excited to be here and talk about this fun topic.
We'll talk about the how in a moment, how you tickle a rat, but tell me why you would want to.
So we say we're tickling rats, but I want to set this out at the very beginning. We're not actually tickling them. It's actually more similar to how you would play with your dog. But it's the fact that when you're doing part of the action, it looks like you're tickling a little kid. And so that's really where the term came from. And it's a way to really create, you know, a positive interaction. You know, we do this with kids. We do this with our dogs. And so in the laboratory, it's a really great opportunity for creating those positive interactions with our laboratory rodents.
But wait, but they're not pets. Lab rats are not pets. So why do you need to have positive interaction with them?
Because I think there's multiple reasons. Number one, ethically, you know, the people who work with laboratory animals are extremely passionate about their welfare. And so this is a really great way of creating that positive experience for the animals in the laboratory. And, you know, it's and not only that, but it's fun for the people too. So it's really kind of a win-win situation, playing with the rats, enjoying it yourself. So it's really beneficial in establishing that culture of care.
You do this in addition to whatever science you're trying to do. So, I mean, doesn't it affect the outcome somehow?
You know, I would argue that having that relationship with that animal makes you more likely to really establish that culture of care. Because if you're invested in that animal's experience, you're more likely to make sure that they are well cared for. And so from the human perspective, I think that that's beneficial. From the scientific perspective, you know, if we have animals that we're doing this research on that, you know, aren't just stressed from being handled by a human, you know, that's just something that naive animals, you know, it's not necessarily just rats, but, you know, when you go to the vet and a new vet, in fact, I experienced this a few weeks ago, taking my dog into a new vet, he doesn't understand what's happening. And he doesn't know these people. And so this is a way for us to create that bond, that relationship with the animals, for them to trust us and let them kind of understand how things are going to happen. So by doing that and establishing that relationship, those animals are just innately going to be less stressed. And so this really translates to, you know, better welfare means better science. We're working with animals that just simply our presence, not stressing them nearly as much.
Oh, so rather than, because I was thinking of it from the perspective of you having a bond, a human having a bond with the rat would skew the science, but it could just as well go the other direction, or maybe more so, that if the rats are, like, you know, if what you're measuring is their deep fear of humans, then that's skewing your results potentially.
Yeah. And, you know, handling related confounds is something that's, you know, been very historically, you know, demonstrated in the literature. Mm-hmm. And so this is a way to kind of negate that confound altogether.
Hmm.
Because when the animals are eager to interact with you, even if you have to do something that, you know, like give them a drug or something along those lines, it's actually amazing. They are eager to interact with you right after it's done. And that's one of the things that we see with the tickling is that, you know, they don't seem to care when that initial fear goes away. They immediately want to go back to playing. And so behaviorally, you can see a huge difference in them, you know, wanting to interact with humans.
So if I'm in a lab watching you tickle a lab rat, Brianna Gaskell, what am I watching? What are you doing?
So the main reason why we decided to create that certification course. So my lab was really eager. We did not develop rat tickling. That was done by a very prestigious neuroscientist, Jaak Panskep. And he was looking at it more in terms of really understanding animal emotions. And one of the things that some colleagues had seen is that, you know, this is something that we can apply for general husbandry. And so one of the challenges that we saw with this particular technique is that it's harder than it looks. And so there are certain key aspects that you need to do in order to tickle appropriately or accurately.
Hmm.
And that those being twofold. And this is where the tickling motion comes into mind. You kind of wiggle your fingers on the nape of the neck of the rat. That's one aspect of kind of the play behavior of rats. And then the hard part, and this is the part that really kind of made us think we need to do some type of certification course for this, is that you flip the rats over and you pin them. So thinking about your dogs, when they run around, they might jump on each other's backs, but then usually one of them will turn over and the other one will stand on top. Well, you're really just mimicking that similar behavior with your hands. And so it's the flip and the pin that's actually much more difficult than it seems.
Hmm.
And so that was one of the things that we noticed a lot of people were struggling with was, and the part that's really important about that is that the pin is the most important part for the animals understanding this interaction, that it's playful. And so the pin is really, really important. And we noticed that people were really struggling with this. So we wanted to put together, you know, a certification course, but really more than anything, just a training course in order to help people understand how to do this technique appropriately.
Okay. So Dr. Gaskell, steps to properly tickling a rat. First, you approach it. I assume the rat is in some kind of an enclosure. Maybe it's in an aquarium or something like that, right? You stick your hand in there. And you sort of, I guess, tickle or kind of ruffle the fur right at the back of their neck, where a lot of dogs like to be scratched, right? So you do that for what, just a couple of seconds?
just, yeah, a very brief wiggling of your fingers, just kind of at the nape of that neck.
Okay.
And then you grab the rat underneath their arms, kind of like underneath their armpits, like you would do, you pick up somebody underneath their armpits.
Okay.
And you, and this is the part where it looks kind of funny. You kind of flick their butts forward and turn them over and pin them. And then you kind of tickle them, do that finger wiggling, tickling motion on their bellies for just a second. And the thing is that in about 15 seconds, you want to do about three of those pins. So that nape or dorsal contact, that flip and that pin about three times in about 15
Whoa,
seconds.
These are very fast then. It's very
yes.
short. Very,
yeah.
It's like tickle, flip, tickle, tickle, flip, and then you just let go and the rat doesn't like jump up and run away terrified. Like, why are you flipping me over like this? Because if you did that to me, I would not be happy.
No, you're exactly right. So maybe the first time we do it, they're like, what is going on right now? But we notice that after you get through that first initial experience, that second and third one, they figure it out really, really quickly. And the research that my lab has done at Purdue with this amazing graduate student, I have to make sure to mention her, Megan LaFollette. She was the one who did this as part of her thesis work. We found that you need to do it at least three times. And in that particular study, we found that if you did a 15-second tickling session 3 days in a row for one rat, that we saw the exact same behavioral benefits and desire to interact with a human as we did it for 5 days. And so it seems like the minimum dosage, as we like to call it, of tickling is just 15 seconds, three times.
Hmm.
And the other thing that something that our lab is in training people, we noticed that you can probably do that a lot more quickly. It doesn't have to take 3 days, but you need give the animals a little time to rest in between tickling sessions. And they definitely, even by the end of the day, from some of the workshops, yes, there are workshops that my lab has given in how to train people how to tickle. We see a huge difference on the animals, you know, at the beginning of the day versus the end of the day. They're running towards your hand and they do these little, it's really cute, these little play nibbles. They kind of nibble on your hand. It's thought to be play facilitation. So like, hey, come on, come play with me. That they will run to your hand, do these little nibbles. And it's really cute. There's a video of Dr. Panskep, I believe from the Discovery Channel, where he is moving his hand around the cage and the rats are darting to try to interact and have him tickle them.
Hmm. How do we know for sure that the rats enjoy this?
No, that's a fabulous question. So there's several indications, and a lot of this came from the work that Dr. Panskep did, is that we can do some things behaviorally. So this is something that my lab did, in that, you know, we can do the tickling session and then we can allow the animals, look how long it takes them to approach the tickler. So if we do the tickling session, if they really, really are excited to interact with us, you know, they will run across the cage in order to interact with our hand again. And so that would indicate that that's something that they like. But if this is something they didn't like, we would expect them to, you know, maybe sit on the complete opposite side of the cage and not approach our hand. So take a lot of time to come around to interact with our hand. And it's pretty universal, at least from a systematic review that my previous student had done, that's a really pretty good indicator that this is something that they like. So we can look at behavioral tasks. We can look at just general behaviors, you know, is there crouching? But one of the really strong indicators that Dr. Panskep's lab did is looking at the activation in the brain of interacting and doing these tickling procedures. And so they're able to show that that when the rats are playing, they actually give off these really cool vocalizations. We can't hear them because they're in the ultrasound. But these vocalizations seem to correlate with activation of the reward center of the brain. So in terms of neurologically, this seems to be the case that these interactions are rewarding.
And so is the best practice then that any laboratory that's using rats, and this is just rats, it doesn't work for mice, right?
Yeah, please don't try this with mice. You will probably be bitten because mice and rats play completely differently.
I see. And this is the reason why this works with rats is because it's very specifically mimicking a kind of play that rats do. Specifically,
absolutely.
And does it have to be young rats only? Do older rats also play this way?
Yeah, no, it's another fabulous question. So rats engage in a lot of this social play when they're young. So, you know, right around weaning, I think, is kind of the peak of when they play so much. They spend a lot of time playing with each other. And just like kids, you know, you kind of see play taper off as we get older. But at least the work that's been done previously, that if you start tickling the rats when they're young, right around weaning within maybe 6 weeks of age, that they, you can continue to interact with them like that, you know, well into adulthood. So as long as they're kind of exposed to it at an early age, they seem to be open to being tickled for quite a long time. But, you know, that's one of the things that my lab was advocating and we put into the training courses to read your rat. Because, you know, they're, as you said, you don't like being tickled. And there are definitely a few rats that are not really into it for sure. And so being able to, you know, read those behavioral postures and make sure that if this is a rat that after you've done those three tickling sessions, still isn't really not responding, we highly recommend not continuing to try to interact with those rats that way. But it definitely seems to be a pretty small minority that don't like it.
And having that bond with your lab animals has to also make you think very carefully about everything that you do to
Absolutely.
That animal. So
Absolutely.
If you could just, you're actually what's called a 3R scientist. Could you explain what that is and sort of what that approach is to using animals in science?
Yeah. So the 3 R's stand for reduce animal use. So we want to minimize the number of animals that are being used for biomedical research. Refine, and this has to do with ways that we can improve the animal experience. As you mentioned, you know, we may have to do things depending on what that is that may be challenging and in reducing that animal's experience. And so are there ways, so tickling is one of them, you know, this is a refinement to just captivity. So even thinking about the way that we house zoo animals, the way that we house, you know, farm animals, the way that we house even our own pets, sometimes captivity can take its toll just in general. And so these are ways for us to improve and refine that captivity experience. So, and then the last R is replace. And this is a big motivation to try to eliminate live animals from biomedical research altogether by using some alternatives that can give us the same data. So this could be cells in a petri dish. There's some really, really exciting technologies that are coming out, something called organ on a chip, where basically we can do tests on lung tissue or blood circulation or immune function in a chip. It looks like a circuit chip. So these are ways that we can replace using live animals in research. And so that's really what my job is all about, is applying those to biomedical research. And, you know, my animal welfare training comes in and plays a big part of that refinement piece. But it's really looking at all three of those and how we can apply those to biomedical research.
Brianna Gaskill established rat tickling training and standards while she was a professor at Purdue University. She's now an animal welfare scientist at the pharmaceutical company Novartis. Brianna, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. This was fun. Thanks.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, a lot of us were raised not to talk to strangers. Stranger danger, right? Well, that was bad advice. Talking to strangers can make you happier, smarter, and more interesting. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. When is the last time you actually glanced up from your phone or your grocery cart, looked a stranger in the eye, and struck up a conversation? My feelings in a moment like that alternate between fear, talking to strangers is scary, and frankly, disinterest, why do I want to talk to some random person? Journalist Joe Cohane has a message for people like me. Just do it. Talking with strangers, says Cohane, can make you happier, smarter, and more interesting. His new book is The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Joe Cohane, welcome. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Julie. I'm psyched to be on.
Prove your thesis to me. Tell me about an encounter you have had with a stranger that made you happier, smarter, or more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, so when I was doing this book, I deliberately sought out a lot of these encounters while digging through the research. So I had hundreds of them. But I'll give you a good example. There was one that was a homeless woman that I met on 42nd Street in New York City, where I live. And she had a sign that said, "I've lost everything but my smile and my hope." And I think ordinarily I might have noticed that, but, you know, maybe I would have given her some money and kept walking. But that time I decided to engage. And it turned out that she had an extraordinary life story, a really incredible story. And her experiences out on the street were, you know, by turns, terrifying and hilarious and surreal. And she and I became friends. And, you know, that allowed me to, you know, help her out a little bit more, because when I went to visit her, I'd bring her some food. But she, you know, allowed me to understand the experience of someone who lived on the streets of New York. And in doing that, you know, we're all kind of intellectually aware of how hard that can be. But it's not until you really talk to someone that you internalize it, that it becomes much more visceral. And it just made me much more cognizant of that problem and what it's like for that population. And, you know, made me feel as though I should make the effort to help a little bit more.
Hmm. This is not your default mode. For some people it is, though. I chuckled at your description of your parents. Would you tell us what it was like growing up with them?
Yeah, I was raised by funeral directors, actually, but they were very chatty. So my parents are pretty unafraid about seeking out these sorts of interactions. They'll reach across a table in a crowded restaurant and start talking to somebody if they see something that's interesting to them. And they're really good at it. They're so warm and they're so open and they're so inquisitive that people let their guards down. And I kind of grew up watching that, seeing them live like that, seeing how rich a life it was. And I saw them make friends. And I still, to this day, I see them make friends. For me, though, I was kind of in the middle of the spectrum. I mean, I talked to strangers as part of my job as a journalist. And I used to talk to strangers more in kind of public situations, if you're on the train, if you're in a bar, something like that. You know, not as much as my parents, but enough to know that it's interesting, that it's a good source of serendipity and hilarity and sometimes poignancy. But I realized, you know, a little while ago, before I started this book project, that I had stopped completely. I had completely cut out that entire category of human interaction. And I wanted to know why. I wanted to know what made me stop doing it. And I wanted to know what happens when we do seek out those interactions, when we do talk to strangers. And that sent me down about 15 different rabbit holes.
Yeah. Well, and some of them are anthropological and, you know, biological, evolutionary in perspective. So share something interesting you learned from those rabbit holes of research about the nature of, you know, about sort of what, why it's so difficult to talk to strangers and or why it's of value to humans.
Yeah, sure. So the first question is a big question. And there are a cocktail of factors that conspire to keep us from doing that. It can be anything from, you know, being subjected to a lot of stranger danger propaganda when we were kids. You know, certainly when I was a kid, it was an endless parade of cops coming into my classroom, warning us that literally everyone in the world we'd never met poses a mortal threat to us. Mm-hmm. It turns out that that's not a great message to teach kids, because kids, when they're in a crisis situation, are often going to have to turn to strangers. But that can affect our trust. It can affect the perception of people around us. Social stress, social factors, you know, kind of racism, things like that can really factor into it. But, you know, according to one of the psychologists, a woman, Jillian Sandstrom at the University of Essex, who's really extensively studied this, the one thing that is most common that keeps people from having these interactions is a fear that they don't know how to do it. Right. So they fear that, they're worried that they're not allowed to do it. It's against the social norm, which it kind of is. But they're worried that even if they were going to try, they were going to stink at it. They weren't going to know what to say. They were going to look weird. The people are going to reject them. All these things. It seems like that's the single biggest stumbling block to getting people to have these interactions.
Yeah. OK, well, I'm nodding my head to all of those. And so you you actually highlight you offer some really very specific, concrete advice for how to go about doing this. But help me with the other side of it. The why should I bother? I mean, all right. So maybe you could have some interesting conversations, but You know, am I really missing out that much, like fundamentally to the human experience, if I don't talk to strangers right. on a regular basis?
Yeah, it turns out that you are missing out by not talking to people that you don't know. Over the last 15 years or so, we've seen a raft of new psychology research into what happens, you know, not only what keeps us from talking to strangers, but what happens when we do. And those researchers have found, and you know, this research has taken place everywhere from Toronto to Turkey, that when people do engage with strangers, when they take the initiative to chat with someone at the coffee shop or, you know, God forbid, talk to someone on the train or the bus, they find that it goes very well. They find that it goes much better than they expected. They find that it's pretty easy to find something to talk about. The studies have found that these conversations go on significantly longer than the people expected them to, in a good way and in a way that pleases the people. They're not trapped in an endless conversation. Hmm. But they come away from these interactions, and these could be fleeting, they could be more meaningful, whatever, feeling happier, feeling less lonely, feeling more connected to the places where they live. There's even research that shows that contact with people who are different than us can alleviate prejudice. It can alleviate polarization. And, you know, the big thesis for the book for me is that it really is an engine for empathy at a time when there's a shortage of empathy. When you do interact with a stranger, number one, if it does go well, and it usually does, you gain a maybe more balanced or more positive perspective of humans. And if you're talking to a stranger who's different from you, who has a different perspective or has a different background, it gives you the opportunity to experience their life for a moment, right? It gives you, it takes away the luxury of believing that everyone's reality is the same as your reality. It gives you understanding, it gives you empathy. And you know, if practiced enough and mindfully enough, I think it'll make for a wiser person and a better citizen.
So that means that the kind of conversation you have with strangers matters. It's got to be more than the, hey, how you doing? Oh, I'm fine. Good. How are you? I'm fine. Have a nice day, buddy. Right. Like
yeah,
that's not really going to get you the benefit.
Right. But those conversations, you know, this was a really interesting vein of research for me, is that when we have those interactions, those kind of mindless rote interactions, we buy something, you say, hey, how you doing? Good. How are you? Fine. Whatever. No one's really listening. No one really cares. And no one's really paying attention. You can use those, what they call scripted interactions, to initiate a better conversation. So I spent time with a woman named Georgie Nightingale in England, who teaches classes on conversation. And she taught a class on talking to strangers, which I flew to London to take. And her idea is that you can subvert those scripted interactions. You can take a mindless, empty interaction and actually turn it into something good. And the way you do it is by answering truthfully and specifically. So that doesn't necessarily mean that when someone asks how you're doing, you give them like a litany of your medical complaints necessarily, but you can be honest and you can be specific. And Georgie's genius trick that she came up with for this is when someone says, how you doing? And they don't, you know, they're not really asking. Answer numerically, give them like a numerical answer. Say, well, I'd say I'm about a 6 out of 10. And then you ask them how they're doing. And what you've done is you've reframed the conversation. You've like set the terms for how this interaction is going to go. And it alerts the person to the fact that something new is happening here, that you are actually engaged, you're actually paying attention, and you're actually asking a question. And I've done this a million times, and it usually results in them giving a numerical answer back. And now you're talking, right? Like they've given you something about themselves. And this doesn't have to take forever. These can be quick. And then Georgie recommends asking them if they say, I'd say I'm about a 7 out of 10, ask them what it would take to get them to a 9. Hmm. And then they'll tell you a little bit about their day. And then you can, you know, you'll find something in common, or you'll get a little story or something like that. But most importantly, you'll have this little connection. And those little connections can be really important. You know, if you have enough of them, they really can be a hedge against something like loneliness, which is a serious social problem right now.
Really? Just this little random, it's not a heart to heart. It's just a little, oh, well, now I know that the cashier at the grocery store, you know, that her mom's sick.
Yeah, I had a great one with there was a teenage girl at the grocery store near me. And I went in and, you know, I was kind of using some of these techniques. I was doing some shopping and she asked me how I was doing. And I had my daughter was 3 at that point and she was experiencing some serious sleep problems. So I was just like, you know, I'm doing pretty well, but to be honest with you, I'm kind of wiped out. Like my kid, she just kept me up all night last night. And the girl who's, you know, different age, different race, she goes, how old is she? And I was like, she's 3. And the girl looks at me and she goes, it'll get better. And I love that. And that's all it was, you know, and I was grateful and it felt like a little bit of connection and, you know, kind of connection across a couple different boundaries. And I think, you know, I paid attention to her. She paid attention to me. It just took a second. But I came away from that, like feeling a little spark of connection. So it can be that easy. You know, it's great if you have like a real conversation too, but even the little ones can really work. They can really bind you to the place that you live.
What's a strategy for striking up a conversation? You described like the, oh, I'm about a 6 out of 10 works to kind of hijack what could have been a meaningless conversation when someone else does the, hey, how are you? What about when you're in a situation where people are not, nobody has talked to you and it's kind of not the thing that people are doing? Do you still try to strike up conversations?
Yeah, I got pretty avant-garde with this whole thing when I was doing it. There was a great piece of advice that I got again from that woman, Georgie Nightingale, called a, it was a pre-frame. And so what that is if you're in a situation where it's not the norm to talk to strangers, so you say you're on the subway, right? And everyone's staring at their phones or reading their books or whatever. What you can do in a situation like that is if you start talking to someone, they're going to think that there's something wrong. They're going to be suspicious, right? Because this isn't common. So what you can do is you can acknowledge that it's not common out of the gate. So say the person is reading a book and you're interested in that book, or there's something interesting about that person, or there's some observation that you can make. Instead of just making it, instead of just asking a question, you start by saying, look, I know we're not supposed to talk to people on the subway, but do you mind me asking? And then asking the question. And what that does is that it reassures them that there's not something wrong with you, right? You're not an agent of chaos. You understand that you're violating a social norm. And that helps get the defensiveness down a little bit. And then, you know, by observing something that you're both experiencing, or maybe, you know, asking them a question about their book or their glasses or whatever it is that you're interested in, that's the opening of the conversation. The conversation can proceed from there. You know, I asked a guy about he had like a bag that I thought was nice, and I was looking for a new bag. And then in learning about how we got that bag, I learned about the guy, and we ended up having a conversation that went on for like 10 train stops, right? Mm-hmm. And this is like, it was so easy to do, but you do just have to acknowledge that you're doing something unusual so people aren't alarmed and they're not suspicious.
Can you just imagine though, if everybody was doing this, like we would never get anywhere or get anything accomplished.
Well, it's not like a time suck. That's the thing. So there was some research done by these psychologists, Nicholas Epley and Juliana Schroeder. And they had people go out on the Chicago mass transit system, and then they replicated this in London later, which is considered a much chillier place socially. And the people expected that they would feel that they were wasting time or that they were less productive as a result of like going out to talk to strangers on the subway. But when they came back, they said that they didn't feel that way, because the reality is like, you're not actually doing that much on the subway. You're just kind of occupying yourself. And when they had these conversations, they learned something. They passed the time in a pleasant way. They found a connection. You know, some of them came out of it making friends. They arranged to get coffee with the people that they talked to. So it is actually productive. You know, you just have to be very mindful of it. You can't be the person in the supermarket that's going to, you know, hold a 15-minute filibuster in a crowded place with 20 people behind you. You do have to be very socially aware to make sure that you're not being a pest and you're not obstructing the flow of the city. But for me, yeah, it didn't feel like I was wasting time. It felt like I was gaining something far more than I was losing something.
We've got about a minute and a half left, and I'd love for you to share a bit of the research that you did on the importance, or even the kind of the natural human inclination to talk to a stranger who seems threatening. So somebody who, you know, who's maybe wearing a hat of a candidate you don't like.
Right.
In the subway.
You know, we've seen this, and I go through the human history with strangers in the book, but we've seen time and time again that people have been really ingenious at coming up with ways of separating the opportunity that a stranger presents with the threat that they represent. We see it in greeting rituals with hunter-gatherer groups. We see it in the tradition of hospitality. We see it in so many ways. And really, you know, civilization would not have happened if we were by nature a completely xenophobic, completely anti-stranger species, right? We actually are hyper-social. We're the hyper-cooperative apes, as one evolutionary psychologist called it. We really do have the capacity to be tremendously cooperative and tremendously communicative, even with people we don't know. And when we do that, we alleviate threat and we create opportunities for cooperation. And that's the name of the game when it comes to civilizations, when it comes to societies. It's really difficult to do. We get really stressed out about cooperating, about talking to people from different groups, especially if our group is kind of at odds with theirs. But, you know, the research shows that when we do make that effort, people tend to surprise us. People tend to be much more complex than we gave them credit for. They tend to be more likable than we gave them credit for. And if you can do that enough, you can start to address some of the thornier political and social problems that face the U.S.
That's interesting, that separating the threat from the opportunity.
Yeah, that's the thing, because the opportunity is is society. You know, you look at a city is a city of strangers. And by and large, most cities are pretty harmonious. And people cooperate and people communicate. We've figured out a way to do it. We just have to keep working at it.
Journalist Joe Cohen is author of The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Thank you for taking time today to talk us through your findings. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Julie.
And that's it for our show today. It's been great having you with us as well, hearing conversations between strangers. Hope you've learned a thing or two that might make your life a little more interesting or happy or smart. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Riemond produced the show. You can find lots and lots of conversations about lots and lots of different things you probably didn't even know you'd be interested in by going to our archives. Just go to byuradio.org/topofmind or check out our podcast feed. Look for Top of Mind and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.